Brian, you have to stop.
Oh, no way, man. Chicken fries are back. Chicken fries are getting et.
No, you've eaten 12 boxes already. It's time to give up.
Never give up. Never surrender.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Greetings, cadets. Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema, you lucky people. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that blasts off into quadrants of cinema galaxy heretofore uncharted, navigating through the asteroids of irony without so much as a scratch on the hull. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, Commander in Cheese, and I am joined by my co-pilot and friend, screenwriter slash novelist, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
By Grabthaw's hammer, I will be podcasted.
Why were there not more T-shirts that said "By Grabthar's Hammer" when this movie came out?
Because this movie didn't hit the way that
it should have.
I mean, it hit well, but it didn't. It wasn't one of those movies that anyone thought would have the longevity that it ended up having.
What movie are we talking about? Have you not figured it out yet? Well, we'll get to that in just a second. I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is on iTunes as well as on Stitcher every single week that we broadcast. We're also on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And we're going to be, the movie we're talking about today, there will be a link at the bottom of the page. If you click on that link and go to Amazon, even if you don't buy that particular movie, if you get to Amazon via that link and buy something, you're benefiting the show. So we really do appreciate that.
By Grabthar's hammer, what a savings.
This week we wrap up our series on sci-fi comedies with one I feel might get overlooked by virtue of its star or any number of other misperceived surface flaws. And that movie is Galaxy Quest.
There are no surface flaws to Galaxy Quest.
There are misperceived surface flaws to Galaxy Quest. Basically, if you haven't seen this film, it is about the cast of a long-canceled sci-fi television show that was immensely popular. And as they are kind of making the rounds on the convention circuit and their careers have kind of stalled out, they cross paths with these aliens who tell them that there is an actual intergalactic emergency and they need their help. Because these aliens believe that the broadcasts they've been receiving on their planet is not a TV show, but historical documents, and that they are, in fact, real heroes. So that's the basic gist of the movie,
yep.
Plot-wise. I love the hell out of this movie.
How can you not love the hell out of this movie?
Here's something you need to know about this film. When I mentioned the star being a possible barrier for some viewers, that wasn't necessarily just a personal editorial. The casting of Tim Allen actually forced the initial director off this project. Because the initial director was Harold Ramis. The late, great Harold Ramis was supposed to direct this movie, and he wanted either Kevin Kline or Alec Baldwin to play Peter Quincy Taggart, who is our William Shatner-type character, the captain of the ship in the television show. And when the studio said, no, we're going to get Tim Allen, who I think is actually a great piece of casting, Ramis walked off the project, and that's when they bring in Dean Pariseau. So I think there is a little bit of an aversion to Tim Allen going on with this film, not even necessarily from audiences, but behind the scenes as well, which I think is very unfortunate.
Well, it's one of those things you have to keep in mind who Tim Allen was, especially at this point. He was one of the biggest, highest grossing stars at the time. Putting him in a movie, no matter how bad, meant you were going to make major box office. This was the 90s, and the 90s Hollywood was an ugly, ugly time. And it was very star-driven. It was the last of the star-driven eras. But it came at a time when audiences were shifting. And it came in a year when audiences shifted, actually, where, you know, there was actually, you know, there was a certain point in time when they would poll audiences, what was the number one thing that will get you to see a movie? And it was a certain movie star. And that eventually was overtaken by the answer, a good story. And so Tim Allen was somebody they put on the project because they knew that it would make this a blockbuster movie, but it also changed the nature of the comedy of the movie. It changed the rating of the movie because originally it was written to be a rated R movie. And it's very much a Harold Ramis movie in just how kind of over the top some of the humor is and just how nuanced some of the humor is. And but Tim Allen was one of those people, you know, he was doing stuff like Jungle to Jungle. And
yeah.
And so this was not a guy that you brought in when you were trying to make your next Ghostbusters.
They actually did shoot this when they tested it for audiences. They did push toward that darker, more severe tone, and audiences hated it.
Yep.
So what they did is they took what they had and they recut it to emphasize the comedy, and then, like you said, to get that PG rating. In fact, there are a couple of moments in the film where, if you watch, it's clear that F-bombs have been dubbed out.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's very like Sigourney Weaver when they're about to go through the chompers says, "Well, fuck that," like clearly with her mouth says, "Well, fuck that." And I think they changed it to, "Well, screw that."
Yeah, screw that.
And it's like, yeah, that's not the phoneme that you make with your mouth when you say screw. So yeah. it's really
well,
interesting.
Well, the other one, and one of the greatest hidden gems of the movie, is there's a whole series of bits of comedy that they couldn't quite cut out. Because the movie wouldn't have worked without that comedy there. But they cut the scene in which one of the cast, one of the members of the intrepid crew of the HMES, is that what it is?
The NTE Protector.
Protector. Mm-hmm. Played by Tony Shalhoub, is high. The whole movie, he is high as fuck.
Yes.
He doesn't start out, I say the whole movie, he doesn't start out high as fuck. He smokes a spliff in the break room right before he gets beamed to the ship. And beforehand, he's clear-headed, and he's just like, man, I think we should have just taken the gig. You know, he's very clear-headed. And finally, he smokes out, and then he shows up there. He's like, that was a hell of a thing. And for the rest of the movie, he's baked. And there is a small moment, if you listen very closely, he says something, he whispers it, and it was something that you couldn't catch in the movie theater. But when you had it on DVD at home and you turned up the volume, he sits there and says, essentially, I am so high right now.
So here's my question. Does that essentially make him Spaceman Spliff?
No.
Yes, it does. I think that works. Joke, but, judges? Joke works. Joke plays. That's something I didn't know, but that does explain his demeanor throughout the entire time he's on the ship, which is so completely different from him at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, no, he's like, Captain, they're telling me that the beryllium something
what
or
is
other.
It? What is it, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to get an... And then he turns around and goes... That was right. Come on, bring it in. He does this weird group hug with the aliens.
He's high the whole fucking movie. And it's brilliant. And my wife hadn't realized. We sat down to watch it again tonight because I hadn't seen it in a couple of years. And I was like, I paused it. And I'm like, this is the moment where he smokes out. And just to look at her face, she's like, oh, he's high. And then through the whole every. And once you know that, he becomes the funniest part of the fucking movie.
Absolutely.
Because every time he's around, he's just kind of and it's Tony Shalhoub. Being high as fuck.
That was a hell of a thing.
Which leads to one of the great things about this movie and why this movie still works works so well is even the smallest bits of cast in this movie are great actors who would go on to do really interesting things and play really interesting roles in other parts. Mm-hmm. And they have these small parts in this movie and they totally nail it with all the gusto that you would expect from those characters, but they would never play those roles in this day and age.
Right.
You would never get Keith Mars. I forget him, Rico.
Enrico Colantoni.
Yeah. You'd never get him to play that small role. You'd never get Rainn Wilson as the science tech guy. You'd never have Justin Long as the lowly nerd who I
think he made one or two other movies about playing the lowly nerd.
No, he then went on to do Ed, where he played that same kind of character, and then several other things. But that's the thing is, you know, you wouldn't get, you know, a Justin Long caliber guy now to go and play this small part to, you know, as the nerd that shows up in like four scenes in the movie.
Daryl Mitchell, who plays Tommy Weber, also went on to have a recurring role on Ed. So that's interesting.
Yeah, and you've got Tony Shalhoub, who wasn't huge at this point. He was big amongst film geeks, but wasn't big until just after that. You've got
he was popular amongst those that had seen Big Night. So he had that going for him.
Well, he was one of those actors that did indie films that, absolutely, you know, and film nerds are like, "Oh, it's Tony Shalhoub. I love that dude." But he wasn't nowadays, you know, you see Tony Shalhoub and it's like, "Oh, it's Monk." And and then of course, you know, the film's two big stars, you know, their anchors were Tim Allen and Sigourney Weaver. And even then, still only film nerds were really big into why am I blanking on his, because that's what I do. Snape.
Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman. Yeah. And it was like, oh crap, it's Hans. It's Hans Gruber. It's all, oh God, it's Alan Rickman. I love Alan Rickman. But audiences are like, he looks familiar, but I don't recognize, by Grabthar's hammer, that's Hans Gruber.
He sounds familiar at that, yeah, point more than he even looks
he's
familiar.
He's the Sheriff of Nottingham. Fuck you. He's the bad guy quickly down under. He's
down
awesome.
Your twit, it'll hurt more.
But of course, yeah, of course, now that he's Severus Snape, it's, you know, everybody knows Alan Rickman. And so this was before all of these people blew up.
And Sam Rockwell wasn't huge at the time either.
No, he wasn't. And Sam Rockwell, you know, is brilliant in that movie. And that's the thing is, this movie, everybody fucking brings it. Mm-hmm. Nobody half-asses this movie. And so what you end up with is a movie that you're watching here 15 years later that has this unbelievably great cast. Mm-hmm. And everybody's earning it, and everybody's earning their paycheck. Everybody is bringing it to the table, and it's funny all the way fucking through.
Absolutely. And I think why I love it so much is that Galaxy Quest is a great example of parody done right. It understands all the little nuances and tropes of the original Star Trek series, and yet it doesn't just clumsily point in the direction of them, but instead kind of weaves them into its own established universe. Because that's my biggest problem with parody anymore, is that it tends to be an I Spy book of cliches, which in and of itself, because it's so prevalent, has become its own cliche. Like, it's not enough to just hold up a spotlight to something and go, hey, recognize this, it happens all the time in this thing. You actually, you know, if you're making fun of a certain show or a movie or a genre, the vessel you construct to lampoon that property has to be sound in and of itself. I mean, you could watch Galaxy Quest without ever having seen an episode of Star Trek, and it still works.
Yeah.
I think that's the difference between a great parody and something like Friedberg and Seltzer, where it's just like, hey, do you recognize this? Yes, we're moving on. It's like, okay, but that doesn't, you're not building your own thing.
Well, the other interesting thing is that they're playing around with making fun of geek culture,
mm-hmm,
but they do it before geek culture became mainstream or prevalent. Like, mm-hmm, this is before, you know, the internet is still young. People know that there's Star Trek conventions, but they don't know that conventions are a thing. It's not cool to take the family to the convention.
Right.
Nobody has heard of San Diego Comic-Con yet, you know, except for the, you know, the handful of devoted geeks that have been going for
decades.
You
could still get into Hall H.
You could get into Hall H at that point. You could
walk right in.
Yeah. I mean, this is those days. This is the days when, you know, this is even before Eric Vespi over at Ain't It Cool was going over and covering it online. It would be a few years after this that he would go to San Diego Comic-Con and start covering it, as, you know, because they were breaking news. And so this is before, you know, geek culture was that kind of a thing where everyone was exposed to this. If you made this movie today, and people have tried to make similar kind of films today, you know, making fun of this, it feels like, oh, hey, you're making fun of that thing that everybody goes to. Big whoop. This was before that, and they so nail it. And they so nail all the tropes in every way.
Yeah.
The, you know, right down to that scene in the urinals where the two guys walk in and go, look at all these fucking nerds, man. Yeah, did you get the load of them? Oh, and that Taggart guy. Oh, my God.
How pathetic is that, yeah, guy?
I mean, it was really, you know, that was the type of thing that geeks at that time were really dealing
with.
And
that scene is based on something that actually happened to William Shatner.
Yeah.
That act, like, he was actually at a convention in the bathroom and heard a couple of people talking about what a loser he had become. And I would, you know, I'd be interested to know if that may have led up to his infamous Get a Life sketch on SNL that I think he thought was going to be sort of a loving tribute and ended up backfiring on him big time. Like, you had a lot of very perturbed Star Trek fans after that statement. So I'm curious to know what the timeline is between this event upon which the scene in Galaxy Quest is based happening to Shatner and him doing that sketch. But, you know, you mentioned something about when this movie came out, the internet was still young. One of my favorite things about the making and the promotion of this film is that it was one of the first movies to have its own domain on the internet. But and this is where Galaxy Quest steals my heart. They didn't just make a website. They made it look like a really poorly constructed fan site to the show Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like a standard promotional site for the movie Galaxy Quest. It was a poorly made fan site for the show Galaxy Quest. So it had like screen grabs and bad HTML coding. And it's just like that is almost as good as the fact that the Space Jam website is still in existence.
Yeah, it was years ahead of what would become a trope. You know, yeah. That's something that's okay to do now.
That Uber meta trope.
They did something. They did that with Sinister. The British distribution company made a faux website about the writings of Ellis and Oswald. You know, and I was like, no, that's been done. And I didn't want to say, look, they did it with Galaxy Quest like 15 years ago.
Now,
what
would have been great is if you go to sinister.uk. And it just takes you to a site about Galaxy Quest, and then Mr. Boogie is just one of the bad guys in one of the episodes.
That was my idea.
Damn it.
They didn't take me seriously.
Damn it, UK. When will you get on board? There is no you in the word flavor. You're just cheating.
You guys already have the coolest character of Galaxy Quest. Come on. By Grabthar's hammer. Come on,
by
guys.
Grabthar's hammer. I love that he...
What a savings.
I love that Alan Rickman didn't want the character to be knighted in the film, which was the original plan, is that there was going to be the scene in which he explained that he had been knighted by the Queen. But he thought it was too much of a stretch for an actor that had made his entire living off of a cheap sci-fi TV show to have been knighted by the Queen. He's that proper.
Yeah.
He's like, no, the Queen doesn't just hand these out willy-nilly. And it's like, I don't know. I've
That's
seen some of the
worst Alan Rickman impression ever.
Where the Queen doesn't just hand them out willy-nilly. Hello,
no,
Mr. That's... Potter. That's good. Fuck you. You can't do one.
No, I can't.
No, you can't. So shut up.
Because there is it. Alan Rickman's like Freddie Mercury. There is no substitute.
His vocal range on stage is amazing, Alan Rickman. So yeah, this is the big screen debut for Justin Long. Big screen debut for Rainn Wilson. First major role for Missy Pyle, whose character was sort of upwritten because they got to the end of the movie and went, oh, you know what? There's only one female character in this whole film, and it's Sigourney Weaver. We should maybe add another one. So they took Missy Pyle's character, who is like the female, what is the name of the alien?
Thermion.
The female Thermion, and you know they kind of wrote it up, and then she ends up you know in this relationship with Tony Shalhoub, which I think is hilarious.
Yes, it is.
So I mean, you have a lot of established careers here. You have a lot of careers on the rise, and you have careers right at the onset. One of the things that's interesting is I mentioned that. So it's like the NSEA protector, but then it's like the letters in the protector serial number are NTE, which is actually a tongue-in-cheek abbreviation for not the Enterprise. So there are little Star Trek jokes like that all throughout the movie. But what I like most is sort of the way they take the bigger concepts of Star Trek. Like I love the fact that Sam Rockwell's character is. In one episode, he dies. He's a red shirt. He's the uber red shirt. And he's so beholden to that one job that he had, that one fleeting moment of stardom within the Galaxy Quest canon, that when they're in the real situation, he's terrified all the time that he's going to be killed. So he's like, do I go with you to the landing party because something bad happens on the ship and that's how I die? Or do I stay on the ship because the landing party somebody gets killed?
I changed my mind.
After the fuss you made about getting left behind.
Yeah, but that's what I thought. I was the crewman that stays on the ship and something is up there and it kills me. But now I'm thinking I'm the guy who gets killed by some monster 5 minutes after we land on the planet.
He's terrified all the time that he's going to die immediately because that's who he was on the show.
You're not going to die on the planet, guy.
I'm not? What's my last name? Nobody knows. Do you know why? Because my character isn't important enough for a last name. Because I'm going to die. 5 minutes in.
And then Tony Shalhoub has that brilliant moment with him where he's like, maybe you're just the plucky comic relief.
Yes.
Which, of course,
coming from
is
Tony
exactly,
Shalhoub is
which
really
is exactly
funny.
What he is.
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, and Sam Rockwell's character has so much, you know, when we see him again, the second time we meet him is one of my favorite, like, subtle little stupid jokes in the movie where, you know, we're tracking through this warehouse. and he's like leaning up against a bookcase or you know a shelf, and he's flirting with this hot girl, and she goes, I know your mother. And just walks off. And it's just, it's the movie is filled with just these small moments like that where it's, you know, where they just, it's so smart. It's so sharp. It knows exactly when to throw these small little like almost Monty Python-esque jokes in where it's like, did you catch it? No. Well, you'll catch it the fourth time you watch it. You know, you'll hear that joke later.
Yeah.
And it's not afraid to have the background filled with all these great gags while, you know, the big, you know, broad humor is up front.
Yeah. And I also love the fact that the Thermian voice, the weird way that they talk, the cadence of how especially Mathisar talks.
We are Thermians from the Klaatu Nebula and we need your help.
You are our only hope.
You know, it kind of it's musical, and yet it's also it's just one note at the same time. That was Colantoni's idea. Like when he got to set, he just started talking like that, and they loved it so much they left it in. And I think it's one of the more recognizable signatures of the movie is the way the Thermians talk and the way they move with this sort of like they haven't quite because the humanoid image is not their actual image. It's they use a device to project the image of being humanoid, and they haven't quite figured out movement yet. So they almost look like marionettes who just had their strings cut, and it's
really
so funny to watch. There's so many little nods to Star Trek throughout this, and like for example, the ship itself, the Protector. If you look at it, it's shaped exactly like one of the Star Trek comm badges. Like, it's not modeled after the Enterprise itself, it's modeled after the communications badges that they wore on Star Trek, which I think is great. And the fact that he fights a rock monster.
Oh, yeah.
Which is such a great nod to Shatner not being able to get rock monsters into undiscovered country.
The movie, there's so many in-jokes in this movie. There's so much just great stuff there. And it's why this film, it's despite being 15 years old, doesn't feel dated at all.
Not a single bit. And I think again that goes back to the fact that even though they're making all these jokes and they are nodding to Star Trek so much, it's structured in such a way that you didn't have to see a single episode of Star Trek to enjoy the humor in this because of that meta thing of, you know, all of our, you know, we have this image of, you know, when we really get into our different areas, our different spheres of fandom. We come to think of these characters not only as people that we, you know, like real people, but we start to look at heroes as actual heroes. And I think it's sort of a commentary on hero worship. When push comes to shove, can the people we perceive as heroes actually act like heroes? You know, where the line between fantasy and reality comes into play. And I like that about it.
Now, acting like heroes may not be enough.
It really is very sharply written.
Well, yeah, and one of the best parts of it is that every character has an arc
mm-hmm.
and has an important and realized arc,
mm-hmm.
and it's so great how they all come to it. It's not a film that forgets about its smaller characters. It works because all of those, you know, Sam Rockwell has a fully realized arc. Tony Shalhoub has a fully realized arc. You know, Alan Rickman. And Sigourney Weaver, and Sigourney Weaver has two, you know, arcs. One is, you know, her relationship with Tim Allen, and the other is, of course, her relationship with what her character was on the ship. Mm-hmm. And she has one of those great, one of the greatest moments of the movie, in my opinion, is the moment when she's repeating back what the computer's saying, and Tim Allen's telling her to stop. And she's like, look, I have one job on this ship. One job, and I'm going to do it. And
it's stupid, but I'm going
to
do
it. It's stupid, but I'm going to do it. And just that whole kind of dedication to, look, I'm part of this team. I'm important. Mm-hmm. And coming, and it doesn't matter how small my role was. My job is important, and I'm important. And it was just great how they had these all of these arcs for these characters, and they just wove them together just brilliantly, mm-hmm. just brilliantly. Like it's none of them are left dangling. None of the characters are left, you know, without taking the time to invest us in them without giving them their reward. And it's just so good.
Yeah. And I said Undiscovered Country is actually Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, that William Shatner tried to get rock monsters into the finale of.
Oh, yeah.
And now what I like to believe is that Tony Shalhoub was able to use the teleporter to send that rock monster to Darren Aronofsky's Noah. And I think that's really where we find, once again, the lines between fantasy and biblicalness. I was going to say reality, but I guess that really depends on your level of faith.
Okay, so for those of you who haven't seen this, and you must, because this is one of those essential viewings, especially for geeks, what's clever about this film, what the thrust of the main story is these characters,
the thrusters of the main story,
the thrusters of this, is that we take these characters who were on a TV show and we put them into their own TV show, and they have to realize that, they have to become the heroes that they were in the show. And of course, that's what we've been discussing so far. But it's really interesting how they take this beautifully cheap show that we see several times. And it's beautiful how it looks very Star Trek. It's very cheap. It's cardboard sets. The one flaw I feel is, honestly, in the movie is there were not 1982 TV shows that looked like that. In 1982, production values were actually pretty badass in terms of what they were doing with this kind of stuff. I mean, NBC alone was doing, Knight Rider and The Journeyman and Misfits of Science. But I get why they did that, was to allow the ages to work with the various characters. But it's, here you have, the first time Tim Allen goes into space, Nesmith goes into space, and he thinks he's on a set in somebody's basement. Like, he's not even fucking aware of where he is. He's just like, give him the red proton cannon and the blue proton, just give him both barrels and throw that at him, champ. He's essentially blasted this enemy and is like, I'm going home now.
Yeah.
And then they come back and they're like, yeah, the bad guy's pretty pissed off. You got to come back. And he's like, it's real. See, guys, it's real. And they go up and they find out it's real. And now they're like, holy shit, this is real. The fuck are we supposed to do?
Yeah.
We're actors. Mm-hmm. And how the hell do actors actually become heroes? These people actually built this technology and they live by what we taught on the show, and we just kind of read lines and then went home with our paychecks. Like, how? And so it really is a very, it's the fantasy becomes reality,
yeah.
and it's a very, and the thing is the production value that you see between, like that first moment when he's looking at, the enemy, when he's looking at the
Saris,
he's like, oh, that's really good. He's like, oh,
that's a really good
he's
effect.
Thinking, the special effects team is really good on this basement project that you guys are doing. And when he realizes that it's and the depth of emotion that you get when they're like, holy fuck, we can't do this.
Right.
Like, we're fucking actors. What the fuck?
Yeah.
And then that great scene where you've got him explaining to them, what a TV show is, and this realization that you guys are liars.
Yeah.
You all lied to us. And the profound just disappointment and how that then drives them.
It's heavy. It's a really heavy scene.
And then when it drives them to become those heroes, when they realize what this race needs and that they need to save an entire race of people, it's such good storytelling.
And it's also a direct confrontation of the complex relationship that, people who become famous for one particular thing have with that property. Like, it's that, it's the thing that it's exactly the Shatner situation with the Get a Life is such a perfect example of this, where on the one hand, I understand how, the constant attention and the, sort of the one note joke on and on and on can get tiring, can get frustrating. But at the same time, it's the thing that like keeps you afloat, or it's the thing that keeps you in the limelight. It's the thing that keeps you relevant. So there is a complicated relationship of embracing the fandom and continuing to be relevant, and then at the same time being so tired of trudging through everything that comes along with that fandom, that comes along with that fame, of having to do the conventions, of having to spend hours signing the autographs. So it is In essence, when they go up there and when they're forced to be actual heroes, they have to, you know, like you said, they're plunged into the world of their own show, and it becomes not just the silly thing that they did to make a buck. It becomes not just this thing that they were doing to have a fleeting moment of fame. Now it's very real, and now they're forced to embrace the legitimacy of the things that the fan, they're seeing it from a fan's perspective and seeing how real it is for fans, and they have to embrace that because now it is legitimately a real thing for them as well.
Well, and then it goes to that leads to that great scene with Justin Long where he calls Justin Long on the communicator.
Right.
And Justin Long's like, look, I know it's just a show. It's, yeah. And he's like, it's all real. He's like, I knew it. I fucking knew it. and that moment's just so magical. And it's such a great moment because it's the reaction to that Shatner SNL bit. And now we've mentioned that a couple times, so we should probably explain it because not everybody is keenly aware of SNL 1982, circa 1982.
When Shatner took a big shit on his own fandom.
It's a classic bit, and essentially what it was William Shatner, and I say 82, I think it was late 80s, because it was it's from the cast that was big when I was in middle school, which, according to Lorne Michaels' rule, is the greatest cast ever.
Right, right.
For those of you not familiar with that, Lorne Michaels argues that everyone's favorite cast is whatever the cast was when you were in middle school. And for me, that was, you know, Phil Hartman and Dana Carvey and Mike Myers. And
that was a pretty amazing cast.
It's one of the best casts, but that was, you know, and they do this great sketch in which Shatner shows up to
Spock,
a Star Trek convention, and is asked several questions, one of which is about the combination on a safe that's kept in the captain's quarters. And Shatner goes off on this huge rant.
He stops and he says, look, there's something I've been wanting to say to you people for a long time.
Get a life, will you, people? I mean, for crying out loud, it's just a TV show. You've turned an enjoyable little job that I did as a lark for a few years into a colossal waste of time.
And the audience kind of cheers, and they just kind of stand dumbfounded. And, you know, again, I think Shatner's intention was to just kind of be in on the joke. Yeah. But instead, what it read to fans was Shatner kind of disparaging the people that held him up and kept him relevant.
He goes on a rant about them being living in their parents' basement and never having kissed a girl and yada yada. And it's this big long thing. And then he gets to the end and everybody's just staring at him. And then he had the brilliant end of that scene is, well, that was a performance as if I were evil Kirk from the alternate universe episode. And the fans are all like, it's a really good bit. It's a classic SNL bit. But it did kind of cause controversy of, is Shatner saying this? And at the time, Shatner hadn't been making fun of himself. It was not, you know, Shatner didn't actually start making fun of himself till the late 90s. Up until then, he was still kind of taking himself seriously and was notorious on the scene for being this kind of dick of an aging ex star who was really getting sick of the fans and really getting sick of living this life. And that's what this whole movie was built around, was about what was happening to Shatner at that time. And then, of course, you know, in 97, I think it was, Shatner was asked to do the Priceline ads, which he famously said, well, I'll do it, but I like the idea of this company, so I just want some stock instead of getting paid. And has since made like $600 million off. I'm not joking.
That's no, not I know you're not.
He's made like $600 million off his Priceline stock, which is why he continues to just keep doing the Priceline ads. Yeah. And
let that be a lesson, kids. Not all the dot-com bubbles burst. That one sustained.
Yeah, that one worked. And so he is now richer than God as a result of doing these commercials.
God who just wants to steal his starship for some reason. So why would God need a starship?
So at that point, we're back to Star Trek V again, I guess.
Yes, we are.
The Search for God. Oh, my God. Oh, fuck that movie.
The Search for Rock Monster, apparently.
Oh, God, that movie.
Oh, my God, it makes so much more sense.
It does.
That's why both Noah and the original draft of Final Frontier have rock monsters. I had no idea how popular the rock monster was in the Bible. That's incredible. God. Rock monster!
It wasn't a rock. It was a rock monster. Okay, we're done with that. No, I guess not.
That should be the music for every tangent we go on.
Rock monster. Rock monster. Okay, and people are getting really bored of this.
They've clicked off. They're gone.
They've
beamed out.
Yeah, so, but it wasn't until the Priceline stuff happened and the money started rolling in that Shatner really embraced making fun of himself. And once he started doing that, that's when his career got interesting. He started making fun of himself, and then people started loving him again because they're like, oh, he doesn't take himself that seriously. And then we got Denny Crane, you know, they
Denny Crane.
Did you know The Practice?
Oh, The Practice. No, yeah. I have never seen it.
That's where he came back, and he was brilliant on that show.
I remember that was his comeback. I just have never seen that show.
Oh, God, he was so good as Denny Crane. That created the Shatner that we now have now, that people pay $200 just to get a chance to wait in line and get a photo with him.
Right.
At Wizard Cons. And nobody feels bad about that anymore.
When if they would just go to Krispy Kreme, they could probably get it for free.
Boo
me. I want to go back for a second to talking about how meta this film is in both its construction and its promotion. One of the things they did as a promotional campaign for the movie is they actually made a fake documentary about the show, about Galaxy Quest. And they used behind-the-scenes footage and outtakes as sort of like clips. Oh, there's another clip from the TV show that we have. And then they took people who were extras who played fans during the convention scene to be interviewed about their fandom of Galaxy Quest. And Sigourney Weaver went above and beyond. She actually sat down and talked about how, Gwen DeMarco, not as Sigourney Weaver, as Gwen DeMarco was talking about how when she took the job on Galaxy Quest, she actually had to turn down a small role in a Woody Allen movie, which is funny because her first on-screen role was a very small part in Annie Hall. So it's like just the levels of like, of meta in that, like you start to go down like metaception, like you're in pure subconscious at that point. And I love it. I love the fact that even though they were taking the movie seriously in terms of creating its own story, creating its own world, and making it a standalone product, they were also traipsing over several different levels of meta, not only in the realm of nodding to Star Trek, but sort of capturing the phenomenon as well, like capturing Star Trek as a phenomenon and just that feeling phenomenon. So that's pretty excellent as well. But yeah, so if you haven't seen, if you're still sort of on the fence about Galaxy Quest, don't be, because in addition to everything we've already mentioned, the effects actually hold up.
Yeah,
I was really surprised. I watched this a couple times preparing for the show, and I was like, you know what's weird is that there are very few moments where I'm like, oh, you know, this is clearly something made in the late 90s. There's so much about this movie.
There's only one scene that...
When he's flying over Justin Long?
No.
Oh, which scene are you referring to?
The little jelly bubbles that they use for the teleporter look very like 90s flubber.
Yeah, a little bit, I suppose.
But even then,
I feel like that was kind of what it was supposed... You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel like a limitation so much as maybe just... design misstep.
I think the meta-ness of the movie allows you to forgive it.
That's possible as well.
That allows you to. It's just the fact that they were duplicating an effect from a cheesy TV show. So how was that going to show up? So it kind of ends up working in retrospect, despite the fact that the effect itself was great CG at the time, but is really shit CG now.
Yeah.
But it totally works. Here's a small little interesting little tidbit, just a personal tidbit with this movie, is one of my buddies, the guy who gave me my first big job in the industry was Harry Knowles, and Harry in his bedroom for the longest time had this big standee of Galaxy Quest, and the reason why was when Gene Siskel died. Gene Siskel didn't let Roger Ebert know it was happening. He didn't let anyone on the show know it was happening. And if any of you who have watched the recent documentary on Roger Ebert would know that. But it was something that he kept. He kept his cancer from everyone. And so when he died, it was kind of a shock and nobody knew what to do. And, you know, here they have this hit show together. So what do they do? So what they did was Ebert started testing out people he wanted to replace Siskel mm-hmm. and giving them a week or two on the show. And Harry's very first show was the one where they reviewed Galaxy Quest. And he and Roger Ebert gave it two thumbs up. And on all the standees that went that they made for, you know, that they put out of this movie was had the thing that said two thumbs up at the movies with Ebert and Knowles. And so that is one of Harry's greatest treasures is this two thumbs up that he's a part of for this movie that of course has turned out to be as we're talking about now, a fucking classic.
And I couldn't think of a better movie to end our retrospective on sci-fi comedies than the movie that is itself a comedy because it's making fun of sci-fi itself. So it's like, it's just kind of the perfect note to end on. But of course, before we go, we have to do the junk food pairing. And I've gone way out of my way to do research on this, and I don't know why, except that it's what I do. Don't worry about it. My junk food pairing this week is the Oreo cookie, and here's why.
You better have a good reason for this, because there's actually a really good one in the movie.
I'm going somewhere with this. So, examining Oreos and Hydrox, many people assume that Hydrox were a cheap knockoff of Oreos, and I count myself in the glut of those laboring under that delusion for many years. In reality, I know, right? In reality, Hydrox hit the scene a full 4 years before Oreo. Therefore, it is indeed the Oreo that exists as the different spin on the Hydrox, much as Galaxy Quest is the spin on Star Trek. The further fitting parallel here is that, like Oreo, I much prefer watching Galaxy Quest to 90% of the Star Trek films to which it is beholden. So much like the Oreo, even though it came afterwards, even though it's the spin on the pre-existing thing, I actually like it better than the thing that came before it, the thing that it owes its existence to. So thank you, Oreo.
90%?
90%, yes. Yes, I absolutely...
You realize there are 12 movies.
Yes, and here's another great tidbit that we haven't touched on yet. Galaxy Quest is such an amazing parody of Star Trek that it's actually been voted by fans as one of the top 10 Star Trek films.
Yes, top 10, but not...
Okay, but you realize if you're playing at home and doing the math, you add that to the 12 existing movies, it's 13. That means there are 3 Star Trek movies that aren't as good as a movie that's not actually a Star Trek movie.
Well, yes, there's far more than that. I mean, first of all, you have to talk about virtually every Next Generation movie. Then you've got to talk about Star Trek's 3 and 5. At which point, then you have to ask, well, is Galaxy Quest better than the motion picture?
According to fans, this is all I'm saying, according to fans, of course, we don't know where it falls in the rating in the top 10.
Well, 9 and 10 are terrible. Like, god-awful
This
terrible.
Is the part where Cargill is incensed. Incensed that anyone would dislike a Star Trek movie.
No, not at all. I dislike a number of Star Trek movies. I am incensed by the fact that you said mm-hmm. that it's better than 90%, which is like 1.3 Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
So that means Wrath of Khan and like the first third of 4? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying there are about 2 in total Star Trek movies that I genuinely love, and the rest I can take or leave, whereas Galaxy Quest is a movie that I genuinely love. Right. So by virtue of that, yes, I stand by that Galaxy Quest is better, in my estimation, than, you know, I don't know if maybe...
All right, well, fine, I'm going to...
Maybe it's 90. Maybe I should get a calculator in here.
I'll nail you to the wall. Is it better than Wrath of Khan?
No, it's not better than Wrath of Khan. All no right. one's saying it's better than Wrath of Khan.
Is it better than The Voyage Home?
No one's saying it's better than Wrath of Khan. No one's saying it's better than Wrath of Khan.
You're going to say that it's better than Voyage Home.
I...
Hello, computer. No.
Look, I'm as big a fan of Nuclear Wessels as any other guy.
Nuclear Wessels.
The point being that I would much rather watch Galaxy Quest than a movie where the Star Trek people are sent back. The crew of the Enterprise is sent back to save whales. I'm sorry. Just don't dig it. Not my cup of tea. But as Aziz Ansari once said, that's because I don't like giant pieces of shit in my tea.
Do you think it's better than Abrams' Star Trek?
Do I think it's better? No, I think that may be the other movie. I think maybe Wrath of Khan and Abrams Star Trek and then Galaxy Quest.
Okay. And okay, then I would... It's fair. I don't think it's right, but it's fair.
Well, you've been under the estimation for a while now that I'm always wrong. So why change that? Why do anything to step in the opposite direction? It's not an estimation. Oh, well.
I don't...
Anyway,
it's math. it's science.
It's literally math.
It's pure science.
We may have just proven it with math tonight. Pure energy. So that's excellent. This has been Junk Food Cinema. I really hope you've enjoyed it because apparently we're not going to do anymore. But
don't say that. People will believe it. They won't tune in next week.
Yeah, they really guys, I'm sorry we went on summer vacation, but I promise you that the show wasn't canceled. Even after we had like two or three episodes and we came back, people were like, "Are you ever coming back?" And I was just like, here's a link, and here's a link, and oh, here's a new one this week. So, yes, we are here to stay, guys, I promise. You can find us, by the way, on iTunes and on Stitcher if you want to listen to the old episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Facebook, you can like us, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And, of course, those Amazon links are super important, so please use those. And before we go, Cargill, as I always ask, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at facebook.com/CRobertCargill, or you can find me... on Twitter at massawyrm. That's MASSAWYRM.
That is, in fact, how it's spelled. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Or you can find me doing podcasts and writing the words is over at oneofus.net, my other interwebs home. But yeah, that's going to do it for this week. Eat your Oreo cookies, watch your Galaxy Quest, contemplate the percentage of Star Trek movies you would lesser want to watch than Galaxy Quest.
That's a fair homework assignment.
Yeah, I think that is. Just sit down and watch all of the Star Trek movies, and then I want to, you know, in the comment section you can post this. I want to know where in the top 10 or just rank them all. Where within the canon of Star Trek films would you rank Galaxy Quest? I'm curious to know the answers.
And if
that we
you
get
wouldn't,
to that.
I want to know what happened to you as a child. Who touched you that you somehow thought Insurrection is fucking better than Galaxy Quest? Like, for God's sake, what happened to you? What is wrong that is an okay movie in any stretch? You know, it's just not right.
It's not okay, guys.
Oh, that's not right.
Star Trek Insurrection is a terrible, terrible movie. it's the only one that's worse than Nemesis, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, poor Tom Hardy. I think that guy's going to be okay, though.
I think he'll work out
fine. I think he'll be all right. Well, for Cargill, this is Brian signing off by reminding you to wear lots of sunscreen if you're going to be out under the suns of Warvan. Good night!
Don't you speak for me.